Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my great pleasure to welcome you here this evening to a special lecture which has an unusually long name, the Wolfson Memorial Lecture and the VC Open Lecture. I want to make a special welcome to one of my predecessors, Dr. Stuart Saunders, previous Vice Chancellor, and Anita Saunders, to the University of Cape Town Senior Leadership Group, a number of council members who've joined us, and to the Pro Vice Chancellor for Climate Change and Development, Mark New, Professor Mark New, who of course heads the institution-wide initiatives around this area, and a special welcome to Sir Eric Ash and Claire Ash. It's really wonderful to have you with us. After many years, your first visit to South Africa and your first visit to Cape Town, and it's fantastic to have you. The evening lecture has this long name because this rather long title, in part because of the importance and particular position of our guest speaker. Tonight, Sir Eric will be delivering the annual Wolfson Lecture, Wolfson Memorial Lecture, as part of the Vice Chancellor's Open Lecture Series for 2014. And the reason for this, for the use of this event for him, is that he is one of the 11 trustees of the prestigious Wolfson Foundation in the United Kingdom. Since its establishment in 1955, this independent charity has awarded more than 28 billion rands in grants, supporting some 10,000 projects. But South Africa is the only country outside of the UK where the Wolfson Foundation has provided support, including a number of projects to the University of Cape Town. Some of the recent projects supported are the H3D Drug Discovery and Development Centre in the Department of Chemistry and the IIDM, the Wolfson Building at the Institute for Infectious Diseases and Molecular Medicine on the Health Sciences Campus, the first-year suite and postgraduate chemistry laboratories, and a significant contribution to the new Observatory Square, Ops Square Residence, to name just some of their contributions and support. In May 2008, UCT conferred an honorary doctorate on Lord Wolfson, who with his parents was a founder trustee of the Wolfson Foundation. Following Lord Wolfson's death in 2011, UCT established this annual memorial lecture, Memorial Wolfson Lecture. The first lecture was delivered by Baron Peter Piot in 2012 at the Health Sciences Centenary Symposium, and this is the second, and we're delighted that Sir Eric is able to join us to deliver this lecture. The Wolfson Memorial Lecture at UCT celebrates excellence in the fields of science, medicine, health, education, arts, and the humanities. This evening's lecture is also part of the Vice Chancellor's Open Lecture Series for 2014, and here we invite people from, usually from outside the University of Cape Town and often from other parts of the world, to present to the university and to the public, and it's especially the public that we hope to draw into these lectures, on areas of innovation and areas in which these speakers have distinguished themselves. It's one of the ways in which we want to connect to the community, to give back to the community, and to emphasize the excitement of discovery, of science, and of the important role that the university should be playing in issues, in public policy issues. And perhaps no public policy issue is more important than custodianship of our planet. And within that issue of custodianship, the issues of climate change, a topic that is riddled with controversy. And although the scientific committee is almost unanimous in considering climate change as the biggest issue currently threatening the future of humanity and of this planet, how we respond to the challenge brings about conflicting views and remarkable lack of action, in spite of the agreement that this is the most pressing problem. Our guest speaker, Sir Eric, brings very practical insights into the conflicts around climate change. From 1997 until 2002, he was the Treasurer and Vice President of the Royal Society in the UK. and he initiated a series of reports on energy policy, notably the use of economic instruments such as the imposition of direct taxation, direct tax on carbon emissions, as a way of changing our behavior in the use of energy. This clearly remains a contentious issue, and as many of you South Africans will know, just yesterday, Pravin Gordhan, our Minister of Finance, decided once again to postpone the introduction of carbon taxes in South Africa to 2016. Originally, we had expected them to be introduced in 2015. Sir Eric himself received his education in electrical engineering at Imperial College in the UK, where he also did his PhD under the supervision of the Nobel Prize winner, Dennis Gabor. He spent 2 years at Stanford University in the USA working on microwave tubes, a theme that continued at Stanford Telecommunication Laboratories, which then became Nortel. In 1963, he moved to an academic appointment at the University College London, where he remained until 1985. From 85 to 93, he returned to his alma mater, Imperial College, as the rector, or in our context, the vice chancellor. He focused on recruiting the best possible students to the college. One of his legacies was the expansion of Imperial College into the realm of medicine with the merger of St. Mary's Hospital Medical School in 1988. Sir Eric saw the incorporation of medicine into the broader sciences of Imperial College as a key strategy in taking the study of science across disciplines forward. But one of the other bonuses he identified in merging with the medical school was that they happened to raise the number of women students at Imperial College, something Sir Eric thought was very necessary and welcome. It was also a source of pride to him that 25% of Imperial College students came from outside the United Kingdom, since he felt that this diversity helped enrich academia and the university itself. And so in all these areas, we can see similarities between the values that Sir Eric has held dear in his leadership in higher education and the values that we hold dear here at UCT. Diversity, both from within South Africa and in attracting, in our case, 20% of our students from the international community, from outside South Africa. A commitment also to diversity in gender, and more than 50% of our students are women students now. A commitment to the breadth of disciplines that we have at UCT, and a commitment to attracting the very best students, both to undergraduate and postgraduate studies. After his term at Imperial College in 1993, Sir Eric began 4 years in the physics department at University College London, working on problems of educational technology. And in 1997, as I mentioned before, he was elected treasurer and vice president of the Royal Society for a 5-year term. He was elected as a fellow of the Royal Society, FRS, in 1977, to the Royal Academy of Engineering in 1978, to the US Academy of Engineering in 2001, and he was awarded the Faraday Medal of the Institution of Electrical Engineers in 1980 and the Royal Medal of the Royal Society in 1986. A very distinguished speaker. We are so pleased to have him addressing us this evening on this important topic. So please join me in welcoming Sir Eric to the podium.
Thank you for your kind words. Vice Chancellor, former Vice Chancellor, Professor New, and other people whom you mentioned in your introduction that I haven't quite retained the names of, but ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to have the opportunity of giving this Wolfson Memorial Lecture on this occasion. I myself served under Lord Wolfson, who was the chair of the Wolfson Foundation, for almost 20 years as a trustee. And he was a very remarkable man, and I think I have a picture of him here. And as you've already heard from the Vice-Chancellor, the university here was honored him with an honorary degree in 2008, but he eventually departed this world and has been replaced by his daughter, Janet de Botton. This is a picture of her, and she looks very benign. She is quite benign too, but she does have a fairly firm hand on the trustees whose committee she heads. The great thing about the Wolfson Foundation is that there aren't any rules except that we are sustaining excellence wherever we can find it and wherever we can afford it. Well, to the lecture, the Vice Chancellor pointed out it is a very long title. I really wanted to make it clear that I wasn't going to give a sort of an MSc talk about climate change for lots of reasons. There are people here who can do it much better and indeed are doing it. The center of gravity of my talk is going to be why it is still so controversial. The Vice Chancellor mentioned that it is, and the small amount of action that we can actually put our finger on that has resulted as a consequence of this. So we'll come to this later. There are people who believe that the damage which is done by human activity is the biggest threat that humans have faced ever on this planet. There are people who believe that, and I'm one of them. So the problem is how we tackle this, how we tackle this situation. But let's start at the beginning with the greenhouse effect. The main problem that we have imposed on the world is the emission of carbon dioxide, which leads to the greenhouse effect. There are other things we do which have caused damage, so it's not a unique problem. I mean, it's not unique in the damage that we're doing, but it is certainly the most important. The greenhouse effect is very simple to understand. You have radiation which is absorbed by the Earth. Some of it is reflected, but some of the reflected radiation is absorbed by the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide being the most prominent, and is re-radiated back to Earth. And this is the greenhouse effect in action. I said that carbon dioxide is the most important greenhouse gas. I should have said water vapor is the most important greenhouse gas. And if we didn't have water vapor, then this planet would be too cold to live in most places. So we actually need the greenhouse effect, but it is the incremental addition to the basic greenhouse effect formed by carbon dioxide, methane, and other gases like that that is the source of our immediate problem. The greenhouse effect was originally discovered by John Tyndall in about 1860. He did experiments in the Royal Institution in London which proved that the absorption of carbon dioxide and water vapor by certain gases. And what's more, he also demonstrated that gases that are good absorbers of carbon dioxide are also good radiators. The two go together. He discovered the effect in 1861. It wasn't until at the turn of the century that it was discovered by, or that it was recognized by Alfvén that sorry, I've lost the name. Somebody help me. What the chap in Sweden who realized that the greenhouse effect would be damaging. Anyway, we'll find it in a moment. Um, So we knew about the greenhouse effect in about 1860, well over a century ago, and we've understood since about 1900 that the damage that the greenhouse effect can do. And indeed, even at 1900, it was discovered that the greenhouse effect would be enhanced by burning coal, and indeed there was a calculation done around about that time which correctly estimated what the sort of impact that this would have over a period of time. Well, so the science is understood, and the observed global warming, which we now experience as a result of the greenhouse effect, is also well understood. It is something which has been recognized in the mathematics and the science that has been evolved around this, and there is no great mystery about the warming that we have observed in the world as a result of the greenhouse effect. It is understood, and is understood quantitatively, and there is no real doubt about that. However, there is a question of how serious this greenhouse effect is. Climate scientists have been working on the extent of which this warming is going to take place, and there has been work done in many laboratories all over the world, including a major commitment in teaching research here in the Department of Environmental and Geographic Science. And the worldwide studies have been collected together by an international organization, the IPCC, and we have a pretty good understanding of what has happened as a result of that. We know about the carbon dioxide. This is a graph which simply shows how the concentration of carbon dioxide has increased over the years, and we're now at about 400 parts per million, and it is believed that around about 450 parts per million we may be in serious trouble. This just gives you a more recent, enlarged version of the same phenomenon. The temperature has risen as a result. It's not a uniform rise. It's not something where you can just simply plot a straight line graph through it, but it is certainly there, and it is largely understood. At the moment, the total temperature rise which we've experienced in the world is of the order of 0.9 degrees, which doesn't sound like very much, but nevertheless, the climate is exquisitely sensitive to small changes in temperature, and so it does make a big difference. And this has been the main work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who've just issued their fifth report, and it is only partially published. It's a document which is about 2,000 pages in length. I haven't read it, so I won't summarize it. But there is a summary form of about 27 pages, which I have read, and which is quite comprehensible, and that's something which is very largely understood. It is as the impact of this small temperature rise is something which is described by the IPCC in some detail, and we know, for example, from that the carbon dioxide is unequivocally attributable to human action. There have been debates about this. There are no longer any serious possibility of debating this. Further, that there is a tendency for global warming tendency of the global warming is something which can be analyzed in terms of past emissions. And the theory that is behind it, the models which we can make, are in good accord with what we actually observe. They also predict that there's an increasing tendency as a result for exceptional heat waves. There will be a tendency for flooding in wet regions and droughts and dry ones, and there's a tendency for more destructive typhoons, and this stemming directly from the climate models. These phenomena are in accord with what we've experienced over the last decade. This does not enable us to attribute any particular climate event to global warming. The relationship is believed to be there, but it is certainly not on a one-to-one basis. But nevertheless, I mean, some of the things that we have seen are rather persuasive that it is indeed climate change which is the cause. There was, for example, this quite unusual typhoon, the Haiyan, which hit the Philippines last November and caused 10,000 fatalities. And then, immediately afterwards, in October, there was an extraordinarily violent typhoon which hit East India. This is the Phalen typhoon. And it caused relatively few casualties for a simple reason. That is that it was anticipated. 45 people died, but nothing like the number who died in the previous hurricane. And indeed, the anticipation enabled the Indian authorities to evacuate people from the coastal districts where they were most at risk. And so that was a fairly happy result for what would have been otherwise a great disaster. The other thing, which is really not debatable, is what's happened to the Arctic ice. I'm sure some of you have seen these things before. The yellow line is where things were in the year 2000, and the white shows you where things are right now, or where in 2012. And there is a suggestion that at the present rate of progress, Arctic ice may actually, Arctic sea ice may actually disappear by about 2030. Again, we cannot directly attribute any of this directly to a particular climate situation, but it is becoming very persuasive, that the evidence is growing rapidly more persuasive. So where will we be by the end of the century if we don't do much about it? Well, according to IPCC, they are confident that the temperature will be above 1.5 degrees, 0.9 at the moment, but probably greater than 2 degrees. And there are plausible models which suggest that things may be very much worse. This is one which comes from the Potsdam laboratories, where they have modeled what they believe will happen on the basis of the current situation. And they are of the view that we may fairly rapidly have temperature rises which could be up to something like 4 degrees. This is another example of a model which shows the temperature rise that's taken place since the middle of the century before last. And you can see that the model predicts, again, temperature rises which will go up to something like 4 degrees by the year 2100. It is widely believed that a 4-degree temperature rise really would be quite disastrous. So the question is, If that is the case, and it seems to be accepted by those people who actually have studied the matter, in other words, climate scientists, what can be done about it? Well, one of the problems is coal, burning fossil fuels, but coal in particular. Now, here's the bad news and the good news. You can see that we're going to run out of coals before terribly long, like in something like 500 years. But the damage we can do by burning the stuff in the meantime would be absolutely disastrous, so it's not really good news. So what is the future of coal? Well, the world reserves are there for at least 50 years, but probably very much more. We know there's a growing shortage of energy in the world. We know that at least at the moment, coal is still the cheapest fuel and looks likely to remain that way. And you then ask, what's the chance of coal currently buried not being burned? And my personal guess is this. It's very difficult to imagine any diplomatic processes between countries which would persuade a country that has a lot of coal underground not to burn it. So that is the problem. This is a book which was published called The Burning Question, which really makes the point that if we do burn all the coal which we have underground, we are in serious trouble, and we really must find a way of not doing so. And just on the side, this has some interesting side effects on the stock market, because there are major companies whose stock price is really determined by the fact that they have all this marvelous fossil fuel. And if they shouldn't be allowed at some stage to burn it, it would affect that. But that's a side effect. I want to add one more thing to the coal story. We might think that we're pretty careful about burning coal. All we do is go to Google and find out what's happening in the world. Well, it turns out that that actually is quite an expensive thing to do as far as carbon dioxide emission is concerned. It's been estimated that in the United States, something like 10% of the electricity consumption is directly attributable to the internet. So even if you go on a bicycle and don't use cars or airplanes and just use the internet, you may still be causing a bit of the problem. This quote, incidentally, comes from Subal Bhatt, the vice president of Sun Microsystems. I think it's quite an important thing to appreciate. There is just one possible answer to the coal problem, to the carbon dioxide problem, and that is carbon capture and storage. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the concept. That is, you separate carbon dioxide from the flue gases in a power station, you compress them, and then you bury them happily underground or under the sea. A lot of work has been done on this. Rather little has so far been achieved. I am personally not aware of any major power station burning coal that is currently succeeding in burying the carbon dioxide it produces. But there doesn't seem to be any reason why this should not happen. And I personally think that there is now the beginning of sign of a real momentum behind this, both in the United States, certainly in the UK, and also in China. So that is one hope. It is possible to capture most of it. Other than that, we've got to labor hard at everything. Now, this was an idea produced by Sokolov about 10 years ago. Do we have a pointer? No, don't. Okay, fine. I should have asked about that earlier. But anyway, you can see the bit that's called historical emissions, which, this was 10 years ago, Sokolov thought ought then to go onto a flat path, a horizontal pink line. whereas what was projected, and frankly, roughly what has happened since then, is the dotted diagonal line going up. And he divided the green area, which is the one we've got to deal with, we've got to get rid of, into a number of sectors. And he made some suggestions what each of these wedges might be able to contribute. Each wedge is supposed to cut 1 gigaton of carbon emission per year. We could have more efficient vehicles. Not easy, but it could be done. We could have lots more wind power. Well, we have a lot more wind power than we had 10 years ago, but nothing like 50 times as much. We need to have much more solar. Personally, my personal hope is that solar eventually will be the major winner. Then there's biomass, which has a lot of problems associated with it. But if you burn wood, then you do produce carbon dioxide, but if you do everything right, that carbon dioxide will be absorbed by future growth of more forests. And then carbon capture and storage, which I have already mentioned. And then, of course, there's nuclear. Nuclear could solve a significant part of the problem. I know it's controversial. I have a view on it. My view tends to be positive, but I understand negative views as well. Let me now turn to what is the main theme of what I wanted to talk about, which is, why is this controversial? And there are a number of reasons which one can understand, possibly. One is that the threat we face is a distant threat. It's not going to happen the day after tomorrow. And then we do have a lot of climate skeptics. And these are people who are not climate scientists, who have not made any effort to understand the climate science, but who have strong views all the same. I'll talk about those in a moment. Then the role of the media, we'll talk about that briefly. And then the skeptics have organized themselves into all various organizations. And then finally, there's a suggestion that, okay, we've got to do something, but we can't afford to do it. And I want to touch on each one of those in turn. We've dealt, I think, with a distant threat. I don't think I want to say anything more about that. It's quite obvious that it won't affect us immediately, the people in this room. But then we have climate skeptics. And gone slightly off here. There we are, climate skeptics. Why are people skeptical about what seems so screamingly obvious to people who've actually studied the science? And I have a suggestion to make as to why this might be so. And I think it is because climate science is immensely complicated. It is horrifically complicated. It embraces almost every branch of physics and chemistry. It embraces our knowledge of the sea, our knowledge of land. It embraces almost everything we know about biology, from grasses to trees, from plankton to humans. All of it comes into it. And those of you who've been modeling some of these things will be aware of the fact that what tends to happen is that you end up with tens or probably hundreds of partial differential equations that you need to address and squeeze some knowledge out of. People are not very good at handling situations which are so horrifically complicated. People are much more used to making decisions when there's maybe half a dozen factors to weigh. You can have about half a dozen things in your mind at one time, and you can come to some sort of conclusion on the basis of past experience and common sense and all that. Let me give you one example. of decision making of a relatively simple problem. And that is, suppose somebody is considering the possibility of getting married. Well, there are a number of things that you have to bear in mind at the time. I mean, one of them is it affordable? And then secondly, you might want to think about whether a person concerned is one that is physically attractive to you, whether you like spending your time with them. And then I think very important, you might ask, does this person have a sense of humor? And then how about this? Do both of you think babies are a good idea? Or do you think it may be a rather bad idea? Well, you've got five or six things to weigh here, and I think it's possible to weigh them and use your experience of the world to come to a decision. Of course, one can make dreadful mistakes. I'm happy to say that's one mistake that I have managed to avoid. But it is totally different from the kind of decision-making that you have to do if you're talking about something as complex as climate change. I think one parallel might be the biological cell, which I think maybe have the same level of complexity as climate change. Well, let's talk for a moment now about the role of the media. The way the media tackles controversial problems, they tend to say there are people who think that climate change is a great risk. We ought to have them on camera or on the microphone and get them to explain it. But to be fair, we better have a couple of other people who are of a different opinion. The fact that the first people who know that climate change is a potential disaster know the facts of the case, whereas the others are simply just saying on the one hand and on the other, doesn't really impinge on the audience. So the people watching the show will think, well, it's controversial. Two people think one and two people think the other. So that is certainly one of the problems of the media. But then the other thing that has managed to strengthen the views or the impact had by the skeptics is that they tend to group themselves into groups of like-minded people, none of whom may necessarily know anything about the subject as such, but they like to be grouped themselves together. And I want to give just one example here. We have somebody in the UK who started the Global Warming Policy Foundation, Lord Lawson. He was at one time our Chancellor of the Exchequer. and he collected eight other trustees, including the Bishop of Chester, who also, I don't think, is an expert on climate change. And the number of scientists he recruited, as you might imagine, was that. So you have these groups, and I think of another one too, which has tried to collect information about how valuable coal might be and how that compares with not using coal. But let's carry on, and I want to go to my next theme, which is, can we afford to do it? Or is all this climate change remedial stuff not affordable? Well, there was a chap, Bjorn Lomborg, who started something called the Copenhagen Consensus. And he asked what, at first sight, is a simple question, how to spend $50 billion to make the world a better place? And in order to get some answers, he collected a whole set of economists, most of whom, incidentally, happened to be Nobel laureate economists, assembled them together, and they asked them to vote on various possible ways of improving the world. And here's their earliest example. I think this was 94. Mosquito nets, spending all the money on mosquito nets, or anti-malarial drugs during first pregnancy. combating HIV/AIDS. And then the next one is the Kyoto Protocol, which was the tentative agreement made by most nations, but not all of them, did include South Africa, to reduce carbon dioxide emission by a fairly modest amount over the next few years. What they estimated was what they called the benefit-cost ratio. So for mosquito nets, the benefit that you get is 10 times the cost of the mosquito nets, and so forth. Now, if you want to do something about malaria, it seems to me it is perfectly reasonable to compare the merits of mosquito nets on the one hand with anti-malarial drugs on the other. You can presumably make an estimate of how many lives you save as a result of it, and you can come out with a decision which is best. But when you then try and apply this to the danger the world faces from climate change, it is quite a different proposition. It is not something which you can put on the same table, even though that's been done here. There's no way in which you can compare, make a cost comparison. What you're concerned about is whether the planet will be as habitable as it is now, 50 years, 100 or 200 years from now, which is a very different matter. Now, we should produce mosquito nets to save lives. Jolly good thing to do. There's no question about that. And various other things that we can do with money. However, the result will be that we save lives, which is a marvelous thing to do. But it is just worthwhile noting that we are not short of people in the world. So people die is a tragedy for those immediately concerned, but from the world perspective, it is not that immediate a problem. And indeed, if we should be short of people, we do know how to make more. So I take this as a totally inadmissible type of comparison to decide what we should do with a given amount of money. I'll skip that one, I think. What is the cost of eliminating greenhouse gas emissions? Well, this has been tackled by a number of economists, including Lord Stern some years ago, and he's written a more recent document since then. And his answer was of the order of 1 or 2% of the GDP. So this is what you'd have to spend every year in order to do some really positive good about avoiding the climate change. And at first sight, if you look at it, this might look to you like rather a lot of money. But it really isn't, because we're talking about 1 or 2% of the GDP. And the GDP is not a constant number. The GDP is always rising. Well, not always rising, but the world trend over the last few centuries has always been a monotonic rise of the GDP. And there is no reason to believe that this will cease to happen now. Unfortunately, the rise in the GDP does make us richer, but it doesn't make us richer uniformly between different nations. It doesn't make us richer even within a nation. The inequality that we suffer from all over the world is not solved by the mere fact that on the average we're getting richer. But nevertheless, on the average we are getting richer. So if we decide to spend this much money, which is about $1 billion every year, can we afford to do that? Well, I think the answer is that we can. This is the world GDP rise over the last 50 years or so, 60 years. And this is the result of the economic analysis of whether you can afford it or whether you can't. I'm afraid this is a very messy diagram, and it may not be easy sitting in the audience to extract what I want you to see from it. But the ordinate is simply how much damage will you do to the GDP as a result of spending this much money? If it's naught, well, then it means it doesn't cost you anything. If it's above this line here, then it means that even though you are actually spending this money on the climate change, in spite of that, you're actually doing some good to the world economy. So how difficult it is to be in the region where you don't have to spend a vast amount on the ordinate there. It all depends how much carbon dioxide you are prepared to eliminate. If you only want to eliminate 20%, well, it looks like 1% or maybe less than that may be enough. If you want to reduce it by 60%, well, then you may have to spend something like 2% of the GDP. And obviously, the more expensive it becomes. The conclusion, to my mind, is that we can afford to do the emission reduction, and that there is no solid economic barrier to doing it. Can't do it all overnight, but one can work on it, and there is nothing fundamental in the business which stops us succeeding in doing it. The Vice Chancellor mentioned a study that we've done in the Royal Society, Economic Instruments for the Reduction of Carbon Dioxide Emission. We did this some 10 years ago, and it was a group of us which incidentally included, and underlining them, three very eminent economists. It wasn't just nerds who were trying to put the world to right. It was a serious effort of trying to understand it. And yes, we did come to the conclusion that a carbon tax is probably the cheapest way of dealing with the situation. But there is an alternative, which is probably just as good, which is to decide that you're going to have permits for emitting carbon dioxide, and you will then auction the permits and collect money by auctioning it. And if you need to have less carbon dioxide emission, well, you give up fewer auctions, and they will become more expensive. But, I mean, that's a sort of a detailed point. Carbon tax itself is the simplest way of looking at it. Yes, I read today that you're going to wait till 2016 before it comes along, but that's not that far away. I'm glad that there's a decision that you will, in fact, have a carbon tax at some future date. So that's my conclusion, that if you set a carbon tax, you can afford it. Auction firms is another way. And of course, you've got to do the right thing with the money you collect. And when you have a carbon tax, you mustn't spend it on something frivolous. You must spend it on enhancing the economy. Otherwise, you really are doing some damage. Well, where have we got to so far? And the answer is not very far. This is just an image of, never mind all the layers, just look at the top line, and that is, how much carbon dioxide are we emitting as a function of time? And the answer is, it is still increasing. We have not leveled off yet, let alone got anywhere near the decrease that we need to get to if we're going to solve this problem. So I said at the beginning, or in the title, that I was going to look for an optimistic answer. And I think I hinted already that I wouldn't find optimism terribly easy. I think the answer has to be that it won't come primarily from governments. Governments, particularly in democracies, have a great problem, and that is, democracy is an extremely unwieldy way of dealing with a problem like climate change, which may have its biggest impact 30 or 50 years downstream. Governments have to worry about the next election, which may be in a couple of months, or as it is in the UK, in just over a year. And it is very difficult for governments to provide on their own the leadership which is required. So where is the leadership to come from if we're going to succeed in this? And I do have one possible answer. We need to study the situation, which you are doing here. There is an issue about how you are going to collect the taxes. The Emperor Justinian in the year 535 said, by the law of nature, these things are common to mankind, the air, the running water, the sea, and consequently the shores of the sea. And this is a principle which is making a certain amount of ground at the moment, that you don't actually need legislation. You simply need a recognition of what is available and what is the responsibility of the people in power, quite apart from any legislation. There is sign that it is beginning to have some impact. But before I go to my last bit of optimism, I think I have to show you this somewhat more pessimistic slide. And it is, I think, probably the fairest summary that we have of the present situation. There are one other possible optimistic direction is geoengineering, where you can use engineering techniques directly to affect the climate. You can inject aerosol clouds, which, just like volcanic clouds, will cool the atmosphere. And it is certainly something which is doable. The Royal Society report here goes into some detail, but with a great number of warnings. It is doable, but not easy. And it's the diplomacy which would be involved in doing this should be put the aerosol over South Africa, or maybe over India, or where else. It is fiendishly difficult to see how the diplomacy would work. But it is at least a possibility. So we are still left, finally, with the question, who's going to really take the responsibility for the planet as a whole? And I do have an optimistic answer, which I hope you'll accept. And it's not meant as a joke. I really believe that it is only when the population at large takes issue with this problem and makes it an issue which is discussed in public wherever and which will have an influence on politics. I believe that it is possible when there are enough people who understand something that it is possible to get action. I mean, one takes as an example of one success. It was for a time very difficult to persuade people that smoking was bad for health. But that is no longer really a controversial issue. Enough people have understood it, enough people have put pressure on governments, and gradually we're getting rid of that particular problem. But it's a relatively small problem as compared with this one. So I hope, particularly the young people in the audience, might take it to heart and might like to take it on, because the planet really is worth saving. Thank you.
Stay up here because we'll take some questions. We'll stay up here, we'll take questions and answers.
Okay, sorry.
Thank you so much. That last slide reminded me of the last time I met Sir Eric. Not the first time, the last time when we had lunch together, middle of London, hectic traffic all around. And as we'd finished, I said, would you like to share a taxi? Because I'm going in this direction, same way as your next appointment. Didn't say anything, and I thought maybe he hadn't heard me. But I didn't push it, and so I call the taxi, and then I see him getting on his bicycle parked outside the club and cycling off between the buses and the cars and making his personal contribution and commitment to ensuring that we don't increase our carbon footprint any more than we need to. So Eric has agreed to take some questions and to have some discussion, so open to the floor. There's some roving microphones. If you just put your hand up. There's a hand at the back there, Michael. There's someone next to you already? Yes. Jan.
Thank you very much for your very lucid and clear lecture. I'm sitting next to a young woman who's got a book called Notes on South African Income Tax. So I would like to pick up on the carbon tax issue, which we are going to introduce in 2016. But my question about that is a fundamental problem I might have is that the producers are simply going to pass on the cost, the carbon tax, onto the consumer. So they'll just charge you more for the electricity. And so it's not going to really encourage them to emit less carbon. I wonder if you have a comment on that.
I think the carbon tax is a blunt weapon, which is what I think you're saying. But it is a market weapon. You simply get people to pay for emitting carbon dioxide. Of course, it'll lead to electricity being more expensive. There's no escape from that. In fact, I would say one of the things that hasn't been honestly said by enough people is that if you don't use fossil fuel, your electricity price is bound to go up. Not astronomically, but probably by about 30 or 40%. But I think it's worth it.
Hi, my name is Everest, and yeah, I used to be a PhD candidate on climate change, yeah, so long time ago. I have a question, yeah, which I think we as researchers, scientists, we have to think about, or a recommendation, I can say. There is a lot of debate about the storage of CO2 gas under the ground, the ecological impact, the business who are going to be sponsoring or paying tax, they have right to know how much of CO2 gas will be stored. Let's say, for instance, in South Africa here, how much of CO2 gas will be kept or sequestered, and what will be the ecological impact. So those questions, they have to be raised and to be explained to every single individual who will be contributing to cap CO2 tax. Thank you.
I think you're absolutely right. You can't do this without having the population in your confidence. And it might be hard work doing it. I believe Angela Merkel has decided she doesn't really want any carbon dioxide buried under Germany. I think the right place to bury this stuff, if at all possible, is under the sea. And there is a vast amount, in Europe anyway, there's a vast amount of space for storing carbon dioxide subsea. But it's not impossible to do it in the land either. I mean, there are, after all, places which have not been disturbed under the ground for a million years, and it's not impossible that you can build, safely store carbon dioxide there. But I agree with you, it's a sociological problem if you're doing it anywhere except under the sea.
I'll I'm not that familiar with the argument of the skeptics, but it goes something like this, I think, that there is a correlation clearly between increased greenhouse gases and climate and temperature increase. There's a correlation. You cannot do a controlled study and test it. But there have been in history increases in temperature. I think there haven't been increases in carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases. But still, what they're saying is that this tremendous cost and effort to go into trying to mitigate something which is just a correlation is where the problem is. Can you just expand on your view on that?
Well, you're absolutely right. That is a skeptic argument, and Lord Rawson in particular would say something on those lines. It's not a simple direct relationship that has been traced by the modeling and the scientists. But there is, when you say there's only a correlation, I mean, a correlation can be extremely persuasive. And although you will get changes in temperature, changes in carbon dioxide, and going back over hundreds and thousands of years, these have been traced to some extent. The very rapid rise in carbon dioxide, which we've experienced in the last 50 years, is unprecedented and does actually relate closely to the results of the models. And what one of the things that skeptics say is it's only a computer model. Well, my answer to that is, if you don't like computer models, don't ever go on an aeroplane. You know, they're all designed on computer models. I mean, computer models are a very powerful tool, and we have to use them in all branches of science and engineering. The computer model is in very good accord with the rapid rise that we've seen in recent times. So I honestly don't think that the skeptics have a case there.
Thank you, Richard Callan, Faculty of Law. Now, what's the role of the education sector? In preparing future leaders to address this challenge? And secondly, specifically in relation to schools, what's your message for school leaders, and how would you change the curriculum at school level to prepare leaders?
That is a very big question indeed. But I think above all, I would say one would hope in schools, even in primary schools, I think sensitizing the children to the fact that what we do does have an impact on the natural world, I think is a good start. You wouldn't thrust computer models at them. As far as education is concerned, well, I recommend that you go to the MSc courses which you're running in this university on this very subject. I'm sure they will provide the education that anybody would want if they want it in detail. But perhaps your question was more what the general population should receive by way of education on this. And that is more complicated, I agree.
Thank you. I'm speaking as an engineering professor here at the university, and I'm interested on your opinion as a member of two eminent engineering academies. Why is it that so many engineers have in the past, with it, found it more important to try to be skeptical about the science than to act on it?
I'm not sure I've quite understood the question.
But, many of the older engineering colleagues, when the climate science came out, found it a worthwhile pursuit to be skeptical of the findings of science rather than to start acting on it. Why was that?
Well, speaking as possibly the oldest man in the room, I do have to admit that older people do find it harder to understand the newer things and to act upon them. I mean, I always liked Planck's statement about quantum mechanics. He said when he was young, he assumed that people would understand what it's about and then use it and go ahead with it. In fact, what he found is that the younger people did understand it and go ahead with it, and the older people had to die off, and then quantum mechanics could flourish. I'm not sure that's a sympathetic answer, but that's what comes to mind.
I just wanted to ask a question with regard to, you know, how many people are we actually going to have to involve with this? Because assuming that climate change and carbon emissions are generally carried out by sort of the more wealthier nations and also in nations, the more wealthy people are inside those nations, I just want your opinion if we are going to see that it's going to be very difficult to get everyone behind sort of this move towards stopping climate change. Do we really realistically have to involve everyone in it?
I would say yes, realistically you have to involve everyone. But I also take your point that the responsibility of different nations at the starting point of this is very varied. I mean, the worst offenders, of course, is Europe and the West. Most of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now comes from the Industrial Revolution and what's happened in the last 150 years in Europe and North America. But it changes. And by now, China is emitting more carbon dioxide than the United States. I think this is where the diplomacy is going to be fiendishly difficult, but essential. There must be some way of making it fair that those people who have in the past emitted a lot of carbon dioxide should have to bear more of the burden than those who are developing nations who have so far emitted very little. It's extremely complex diplomacy, and that's why I still worry about whether one can be optimistic, but one has to be optimistic.
Hi, my name is Donna Andrews, and maybe to pick up on Richard's question. I think what you said at the beginning, which was, I came for that, why is this a controversy? And why is, given that there's a global agreement on climate change, why aren't we doing more? And I guess I'd like for you to talk to how is this something beyond a technical problem? Because you've been able to say scientifically, lots of people agree about it. And I think it's really important for us to ask if this is not only a technical problem, how do you understand it?
I didn't quite understand.
Your response to why this is controversial and why we're not making the change has been largely phrased in terms of this being a technical problem, the technical difficulty of understanding it and explaining it. The question is saying, are there not other dimensions? Are there not other reasons for this controversy that are not so much technical issues?
I mean, there certainly are other things than emitting carbon dioxide that are causing problems. Hydrogen certainly is one of them. Methane is another. And the problems that we face, particularly with the permafrost melting in the Arctic, which will emit more methane, is a particular worry.
I don't think I conveyed the question well.
Sorry.
But I suspect it had more to do with issues such as large corporates having financial interests that are much more powerful than the technical arguments and their ability to influence those, or political factors that are the reasons for the failure to do the right thing.
Now, I think the large corporations will not be forward in this battle. At least most of them will not be, any more than the tobacco countries were forward and understanding that smoking is a health hazard. So it is very, very complicated. We can have a lot of people in the world, in the general population, who can be very enthusiastic about making progress in what they see as a very essential problem. Bringing large corporations with them has to be done indirectly, but not only indirectly. Why not join the board of a few companies and you can help there too?
Her question prompts me to abuse my position and ask a question, if I may. a more controversial one, but one that we face as leaders in the university. Should we be avoiding sponsorship from fossil fuel companies as big donors to our research laboratories and our research efforts?
I've been in exactly that situation in the past. So I would say I would be prepared to accept sponsorship from those organizations, provided they don't dictate the line of research someone's going to pursue. As long as one is free to pursue the research wherever it leads one, I would be prepared happily to accept their support.
Last question then. You've got the mic.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for a wonderful talk. My name is Delia Funk, and I work in education. And I am struck continuously by, I don't know if it's just prevalent in this country, but the indifference and the almost blanked-off approach or attitude of younger people these days, how they are really turned off, or it's almost unfashionable, untrendy to recycle or to take care or to think about environmental issues. Or, you know, I just wonder, with us being in such a serious position, why there is such a sort of indifference amongst younger people now. Is it our fault? Have we not put out enough? What do you think this inertia is?
Well, at some level, it must be lack of leadership. whether one wants to put the blame on parents or grandparents, I don't know. I do think there is a vacuum, a dearth of leadership in this area, and we really need somebody with an enormous amount of charisma who's prepared to address worldwide problems and, amongst others, persuade the younger people. But I think, to be honest, I don't have a good answer to your question.
We need to end the questions there, I'm afraid. I do want to say in response or in addition to the last question, though, that one of the things we're very proud of at this university is that the largest student society we have is called the Green Campus Initiative, and the GCI actually draws over close to 2,000 students as members who demonstrate commitment to environmental issues on the campus and off. So, Eric, it's been a wonderful privilege to have you speaking to us. We have a small gift for you as a token of our appreciation and as a souvenir of the university for you and Claire, and we hope that you have a wonderful stay and that we'll be enjoying your presence and your inputs for many years to come.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And thank you all, ladies and gentlemen, for coming, students and members of the public. Please keep your eyes out for the Vice Chancellor's lectures, which we always advertise in the newspapers, and we look forward to seeing you all here again.